Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 2, Act 3. O God, that one might read the book of fate! King Henry, insecure and unwell, muses on time and human treachery, fate and free will. Henry takes Warwick's counsel about circumstances past and present. In Act 3, Scene 1, King Henry tries to catch some rest as battle looms, but finds it impossible. Quote unquote, O sleep, O gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frighted thee, that thou no more will weigh my eyelids down and steep my senses in forgetfulness. Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 5 through 8. This expression of the unhappiness, the melancholy, anxious care that taking the crown has cost this king, is a constant in the Henry IV plays. And Henry ends his soliloquy with a line known round the world. Quote unquote, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Act 3, Scene 1, Line 31. But it isn't only lack of sleep that burdens Henry. It's the sad, defeated thoughts that his circumstances, and sleeplessness no doubt, bring. This becomes clear when he says to Warwick, quote unquote, O God, that one might read the book of fate and see the revolution of the times make mountains level. Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 45 through 46. A youth who could truly read such epical change, says the king, quote unquote, would shut the book and sit him down and die. Act 3, Scene 1, Line 56. He goes on to consider how today's dearest friend or confederate with time will become one's most inveterate enemy, as happened between him and Northumberland. Warwick, too, is in a philosophical mood and replies, quote unquote, there is a history in all men's lives, figuring the natures of the times deceased. Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 80 through 81. Once someone has seen this personal history, he says, it becomes possible to predict with remarkable accuracy what will happen in times to come. As Antonio says in Act 2, Scene 1 of The Tempest, quote unquote, what's past is prologue. But further consideration of both characters' words here, Antonio's and Warwick's, that is, exposes a certain ambiguity regarding the central idea that each addresses, which is the notion of necessity or fate as opposed to free will. Antonio says to Sebastian that while what's past is prologue, meaning that it sets the stage, quote unquote, what's to come is, quote unquote, in yours and my discharge. This could be read to imply that people are the puppets of the past and merely act out what the past makes them do. But it could also mean that the past only creates a set of circumstances within which one must make one's own free, vital choices. Warwick's language seems to license the same radically incommensurable interpretations, since he speaks of, quote-unquote, main chance, glossed by the Norton editor as, quote-unquote, general probability, and, quote-unquote, necessary form, which would seem to indicate an iron law of fate. So was Northumberland, having betrayed Richard, compelled in, quote-unquote, the hatch and brood of time, to betray Bolingbroke as well? Act 3, Scene 1, Line 86. The king, it appears, takes Warwick's formulation as indicating the latter interpretation. He says, quote-unquote, are these things then necessities? Then let us meet them like necessities. Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 92 through 93. But then Henry immediately resorts to the news that has come to him by the untrustworthy prologue rumor to the effect that the enemy are 50,000 strong, a thought that Warwick quickly knocks down with another rumor, which is that Owen Glendower is dead. That rumor, as Shakespeare's audience and we ourselves may know, is untrue. The mercurial Welsh leader's death date is uncertain, but he outlived Henry IV, who died in March 1413. Whatever the case may be, Henry longs to get these civil broils over with, for his uneasy, sleep-deprived thoughts are turning again to his longed-for crusade to retake the Holy Land for Christianity. In his deep feeling of guilt over Richard's death, this is the happy life arc he sees and clutches at for himself, his son, and England. By this stage of our acquaintance with King Henry, we can say with some confidence that his usurpation of the crown has not been worth it, at least personally. But would he do it all over again? That's less easy to say. "We have heard the chimes at midnight, Master Shallow." Just as Shallow reminisces about his youth, Falstaff, crossing through Gloucestershire, chooses recruits for the king's army in a thoroughly shameful and dishonest manner, and decides that if he returns, he will con Justice Shallow out of some money. In Act 3, Scene 2, we get a good look at Justice Robert Shallow, a character who also appears in The Merry Wives of Windsor. The first thing we learn about Shallow is that he is proud of what he alleges to be the heady days of his youth, as when he says, quote unquote, "I was once of Clement's Inn, where I think they will talk of Mad Shallow yet." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 11 through 13. Shallow, he tells Justice Silence, was also a friend of Sir John Falstaff, then plain Jack, who we hear was at the time a young page of the illustrious Thomas Mowbray, 1st Duke of Norfolk. That's the same Mowbray who was exiled by Richard II in the first play of the Major Tetralogy to settle his quarrel with none other than Henry Bolingbroke, now Henry IV. Shallow continues reminiscing about his supposedly wild youth, saying, "Jesu, Jesu, the mad days that I have spent, and to see how many of my old acquaintance are dead." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 29 through 31. This focus on the past is hardly unusual in elderly people, whose personal reference points are often strongly tied to a past that stretches back many decades and offers the benefits of recollected and sometimes imagination-assisted vigor and adventure. Bardolf and Falstaff soon arrive, and after an affectionate greeting by Justice Shallow, they get down to the business of choosing among several potential army recruits whom the justice has lined up for them. Here we get to see the all-too-common fraud involved in such conscription practices. Falstaff makes his choices from an unlikely bunch, and the two least pathetic choices bribe Bardolf on the sidelines to unchoose them, which he does without batting an eyelash. Falstaff is apprised of this hustle and adjusts his final choices accordingly to include only the poorest, least capable men. When Shallow remonstrates with him over his poor recruiting choices, Falstaff is offended and says, quote unquote, "Will you tell me, Master Shallow, how to choose a man? Care I for the limb, the thews, the stature, bulk, and big assemblance of a man? Give me the spirit." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 232 through 234. "No," he says, "Bullcalf and Moldy can stay undrafted. He'll take Messieurs Wart, Shadow, and Feeble any day, and march them off to war." At intervals during this sorry process, Shallow reminisces in Sir John's presence about what he assumes to be their shared memories and perspectives as young men. He asks him, quote unquote, "Oh, Sir John, do you remember, since we lay all night in the windmill in St. George's Field?" Act 3, Scene 2, lines 175 through 176. Falstaff seems reluctant to say much, but he does offer the lovely sentence, quote unquote, "We have heard the chimes at midnight, Master Shallow," presumably meaning that they were lusty enough to stay awake until that hour, and thereby heard the bells of the town clock chime. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 193 through 194. Falstaff's poetical, almost mystical phrasing contrasts with Shallow's fittingly more shallow way of remarking on his own party-hard exploits of yesteryear. But alone, Falstaff muses, quote unquote, "Lord, how subject we old men are to this vice of lying." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 271 through 272. He goes on to offer an unforgettable portrait of the young, preternaturally scrawny Robert Shallow. Most notably, he says, quote unquote, When he was naked, he was for all the world like a forked radish with a head fantastically carved upon it with a knife. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 277 through 279. All this fine imagery aside, Sir John's use for Justice Shallow is as practical as can be. If he is lucky enough to make it home from the wars, he says, he will take Shallow up on his offer of a visit to his place and give free rein to his most predatory, money-grubbing self. Quote unquote, if the young dace be a bait for the old pike, I see no reason in the law of nature, but I may snap at him till time shape and there an end. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 294 through 297. Item, little fish to be snapped up by big fish. It's interesting to compare the ways of doing history we can discover in Henry IV, Part 2. We have just witnessed Justice Robert Shallow's self-aggrandizing approach to his personal history, in which distorted recollection helps him to a better version of himself than anyone else ever knew. Falstaff puts this down to conscious lying and uses that to justify his intention to fleece Shallow on the way home. But to us, Shallow's nostalgic effusions may read as partly deliberate fiction and partly sincere, if faulty, remembrance. Falstaff's brief, mystic response to Shallow's representation of their shared past is most likely ironic and possibly even to be issued with a surreptitious eye roll. Still, the words may be spoken with relative sincerity. Few of us are entirely immune, after all, to a bit of nostalgia now and then. In the previous scene, Act 3, Scene 1, we heard both King Henry and the Earl of Warwick trying to come to terms with the relation between the past, the present, and the future. Henry in particular has a mostly honest, if bitter, relation to his own remembered past. He is at times startlingly open about the sins he committed in coming by the crown. His guilt is mainly the purpose, as he admits, for his abiding, aching desire to return to the Holy Land. Finally, there is Shakespeare's multifaceted relation to the historical chronicles and other materials out of which he partly weaves his history plays. He feels free to telescope and rearrange historical timelines and to change the ages of his characters, or even to conflate them. The romantic poet Percy Shelley's friend Thomas Love Peacock wasn't being entirely frivolous in The Four Ages of Poetry when he wrote that, quote-unquote, Shakespeare and his contemporaries, ellipsis, used time and locality merely because they could not do without them, because every action must have its when and where. Still, Shakespeare keeps a sort of faith with his country's history that is no less deep for its sometimes compromised and confusing quality. The playwright dramatizes that history in a manner that fixes it in our imagination. We sense the shock of strong personalities, recognize the traps into which selfish or incompetent rulers were apt to fall, and come to know the cruelty, the alienation, that so often existed between rulers and ruled, or between rulers and others of the governing class. Shakespeare was surely aware that even in the Middle Ages, not all of the characters he brings to life for us were easily or completely reducible to the requirements of their era or of their exalted rank, their royal or aristocratic tribe. In fact, he revels in dramatizing the moments when they are least reducible to creatures of their class or executors of their pre-established function. He strives to choose and portray moments, happy or otherwise, when the great nobility of England and the base-born alike seem most individuated, most fully alive to us. The author of Richard II, Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and Henry V, and other history plays, is a dramatist, not a historian, but he is supremely capable of presenting what is most memorable and most useful about the historical events and personages he covers. Most historians today would agree that all history writing involves emplotment and interpretation. That's true even of varieties that aim to be as objective as possible in their presentation of people and events. Shakespeare's offenses against supposedly pure history, then, may readily be accommodated so long as we do so in a self-aware, honest manner. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Thursday, October 23rd, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.